English language teaching under the cover.
Hello and welcome to ELT Under the Covers. On today's podcast, we have the very definition of a teacherpreneur. Our guest started out as we normally do, trotting across the globe with MA in English language teaching in hand, but she quickly branched out as an educator, going behind the scenes into academic management and becoming a published writer with a concentration on graded readers. She went one step further and transferred her skills from teaching into copy editing, content writing, and her latest venture, where she looks at investing, and she helps us prodigal teachers get to grips with our financials. Welcome to the show, Nicole Prentice.
Hi, thank you. I'd actually forgotten about some of those things, so I'm glad you did the recap to remind me.
you've had a very long teaching career where you've dabbled in many, many things. If you could take us back and just let us know how you got into teaching, and we can take it from there.
Okay, so this isn't a particularly great story because no. I did a degree in philosophy, and of course I graduated from that without a clue what I was supposed to do after that. And I did have some friends that went into kind of, you know, advertising, sales, and selling, like recruitment. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't face doing that. So I spent about 2 years just temping, going every Tuesday, I think it was, and looking at the Guardian jobs section and just filled with despair. And then a friend of mine who graduated later was doing the TEFL course, and I was just clung onto that like a life raft. So I did the well. And then I just realized, oh, wait a minute, I can go to loads of other places. And so I just started doing that. And I went to Prague first, loved it, went to Thailand, loved it, with slightly more mixed experiences. And then I just was like, I can go somewhere else. So I went to Spain, and then I went to Turkey, and then, you know, and I just did that. And it wasn't, like you was calling it earlier, a superhero journey. That wasn't very superhero, I'm afraid.
Well, we don't always start out with you know, like some sort of magical hammer that comes down to us or anything.
Exactly.
Like that. Often it's just kind of oh, what's over here? Well, what, really? Oh, if I did this, I got a little bit extra money. Okay.
It was travel for me. It was just like I tried backpacking and I didn't get on very well with it. Mm-hmm. But once I discovered teaching, it meant I could have a base in a place, and then from that base, like, explore bits of that country. And that was much better for me. Living in somewhere was much better. I just never, backpacking always just was a bit rushed and a bit sweaty.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I like the I've been to many different countries, and I like to have one go to places in different continents, so I've got a little base I could explore all the surrounding countries and stuff like that. So at what point did you go, well, you know, I've been doing this for a while now, do I stay in or jump out? Or what point did you go, actually, this is something maybe I'm good at, or something I want to take a bit further?
Yeah, it wasn't that I wasn't good at it. I wasn't really earning very much money, but I was mostly teaching private students by then, but I was getting really bored. And I sort of fell into, again, you know, like a summer job at a summer school, but as an academic manager. And then I went back for about 6 years as a centre director, and I absolutely loved that. I loved managing people. I loved that, the entire buzz and the bubble of summer schools. And I went back to the same one every year. A lot of the same staff returned. I loved it. And if I could have done that job year round, I would have probably died by now, but I, otherwise I'd still be doing it, because it was so full on. But if I'd survived, I would still be doing it now. But those jobs don't exist really year round, and you'd go and try and apply for management jobs, but they wouldn't take your experience, because they'd be like, oh, so you did that for 6 weeks, and you're like, yeah, but you don't understand, that was like doing a year. And and I did go for a job in London. It was some kind of like senior teacher or ADOS or something like that. I can't remember what it was. It was working up the rungs. Mm. And I went for the interview, and they offered me £19,000 in London. In London. Like, and I was just like, I had a master's by that point as well, and the experience of management. And I was just like, this is not right. And so I was still teaching, but I just started doing the writing because I thought somebody writes graded readers. Like, I loved using them, and I was like, somebody must write these. I'm going to have a go. And so I did. And then I eventually managed to pester enough publishers that somebody published it. That one won an award. And so then I was just finding out about materials writing, which was something I didn't even know was a thing, even though it seemed really obvious, because I wasn't going to TEFL conferences and I didn't have any idea about anything other than teaching my classes from course books. So the professional development thing, I didn't do any of that. You know, I was just not in that sphere. Mm. So I wasn't working for big chains. So that all bypassed right. me. Like, when I first started, like, the more plugged in stuff, I didn't know who Scott Thornbury was. Mm. You know, I was that out of it. So it just sort of, it really, yeah. my involvement in the actual wider community really came about from the writing, not from the teaching.
I think that's really interesting, because I actually think the majority of language teachers out there are in that situation. It's one of the sort of aims of our channel, actually, is to attempt to some extent bridge that gap. Because I think, yeah, the majority of academies and language teachers and so on, they don't really have much awareness of what CPD is. And even some of them, when you first mention it, they're quite negative about it, because, you know, it just seems like some extra work. You know, you start talking to someone about, oh, CPD, and they're like, so you're saying that someone's going to come and start observing my classes when I've been teaching for 4 years and I haven't had to do any of that before? Like, what's in it for me? You know, so,
and I'm going to have to go to sessions for which I'm not paid. That's the other thing.
That's very true as well.
Well, it depends on the institution, doesn't it? One of the things I always liked about working for the British Council is they do pay you for the well, it probably depends on the centre, but the centres that I've worked at, they pay you for the inset training sessions, which is brilliant. I've worked at three international health centres, and none of them have paid me for the inset training sessions or the meetings.
Yeah.
CPD on your time. Yeah.
Yeah, and exactly. What's professional about that? The definition of profession versus hobby is something you get paid for. So why would you not be paid to get better at it?
Yeah. Mm. Totally agree.
Mm. Can you give us a recap of what you would be doing as an academic manager during the summer camp? You know, like, because I want people to listen and truly understand the amount of work that goes into just, because it's 6 weeks, but it's 6 weeks of non-stop work. Could you give us like a little glimpse into what that would be, what be like for you?
So the school that I worked at went even one step further than other places that I've worked, because I used to have to plan ahead of the teachers for the week, a kind of a plan of work, which they would then, and I would like find the resources and things. So in order to minimize the planning that they had to do, I kind of went ahead and planned out lessons. So I would spend the entire time that they were in lessons basically planning for the next week, not to the extent I was writing lesson plans, but just, you know, being like, right, this topic, you could approach it like this and this, here are some resources from these books. Mm. So I was really working a lot. And then I was doing observations of classes, writing up those reports, doing another observation if that first one didn't go very well. I had to kind of not mark, but like the teachers wrote their lesson plans and I had to sign them off. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes people didn't necessarily want to hear what I had to say. Most of the time it went quite well. My first year was just pure academic management. So, and I had a really good team, but there were some sticky moments. And then it was like, you know, making sure that all the stationery and the supplies and things and anything extra, because summer school obviously doing loads of project classes, so they would submit their list of things and I would need to go and get those, because they didn't have time to be doing that because they were full on as well. You know, they were doing activities, they were doing their lessons, and then they were planning their lessons. So it was so much teacher support, and I can't remember how many inset sessions I had to do, whether or not I had to do it every week or every couple of weeks, but I was observed on one of those by my boss giving an inset session. So even I had somebody, you know, coming to watch me, and I hadn't done that work before. So I wasn't even used to giving training sessions to teachers and I was being observed on it. So it was a bit like the CELTA, it was really, and I mean, this is going back a few years ago, so there'll be things that I've forgotten off that list, as well as, no, wait a minute, parents writing the reports, that was something I had to check. So the teachers would write the reports and had to check them, but any parental stuff would come back to me. Liaising with the activities manager to whatever it was we used to liaise about, I can't remember now. And oh yeah, there was so much.
Yeah, I can imagine it being absolutely balmy, and I don't think people realize as much of what an academic manager has to do, because I feel it scales. You start with the classroom with the teacher where they do the planning, but you know those materials, they don't come from, you know, they don't come from the ether. There's guidelines and materials that you get given, and then how are they selected? Because it just goes bigger and bigger and bigger in scales. But you're doing it for not just one class, because you know we're lowly teachers just being like, we're just doing it for one, but you're doing it for so many.
Eight or something, yeah. And we also had a British Council inspection that year, and our centre was one of, well, I can't remember if we were the, what, I don't think we were the wild card, we were the one that we knew that they were coming, so I had that to deal with as well.
What's that like dealing with?
Intense scrutiny. You know, they come and they look at absolutely everything. You can get marked down for not having soap in the toilets. They had a say about the resources and the syllabus, and you know, we did all right, but our resources at that point weren't that great because there was a lot of photocopies being used, as you'd expect. They didn't like that. They didn't like that. So I spent the next couple of years revamping. I sort of went back in as an academic consultant and revamped their syllabus and chose course books and had much more involvement with what was actually going to be taught. And we aced the next inspection. And then like 4 years later, when they did the inspection again, I was centre director at a bigger centre and we were the wild card. So I had two, but this time I was in charge of everything. So, you know, I didn't do any of the academic manager stuff by then, but I was doing all the, like, you know, the transfers, the liaison, the parents, the agents, the management of staff, the kids, any discipline problems that would ultimately get referred to me, dealing with the host school and the catering.
Do you find that you basically don't have any sleep for most of the course, and then you kind of catch up on it at the end?
Yeah, but it's so energizing because I loved it so much that I didn't need as much sleep. I woke up like, you know, lightning bolt out of my bed and was working till late at night, and I loved being around the school. And on my day off, I would go and kind of wander around Brighton and just be like, how do you spend money again? I tried to get on a train once, like put my card, like my debit card, tried to put that in the ticket thing, because I'd just become, even in a few weeks, you become so institutionalized,
yeah,
because everything's done for you and you eat there and your whole world is there. And so my days off were never as, I don't know, they weren't really a break. I was always thinking about what I needed to do at school, but I thrived off it. I really did, and I really miss it.
I had a teacher friend refer to doing summer camps as doing like a tour of duty, and you know, like coming back is like coming back to civilian life.
Totally. I mean, I can totally relate to that. I worked as a senior teacher at a summer school, company called Discovery Summer, that I would highly recommend. Actually, it's one of the best companies that I've worked for in ELT, and I had so much respect for the center director, the center where I worked at, a guy called Gary Silcock. He was the center director of Radley School there. It was just an amazing experience. I always got the impression that the management team were basically just putting out fires left, right, and center, like all the time. For anyone who hasn't done a summer school, or for anyone who's done a summer school and had a bad experience, I would highly recommend giving it another go. Because I have spoke to people who've done summer schools and they've been like, I don't want to do that again. That was a complete mess. And it's like, you just didn't get a good one. You know, try it again, because you get a good one. And it's something, for me, it's something that I looked forward to every year.
Oh, me too.
It.
Yeah. built my year around it, I would make sure that I was going to be free for summer school. And the only reason I'm not still doing it is because I had children. And as soon as they're old enough, I'm going to be like, right, you're going to football camp over here. And I'm going to go and run the summer school again. I cannot wait. If a school would hire me, like if anybody's listening, if a school would hire me and let my kids be there for free, I would come and do it. But they tend to charge you for the place that your kids have got. And of course, those fees are really high. Right, yes, wipes out what you're earning. But if anybody would let me, I'm there.
Awesome. You know, leave a comment below. Leave a comment below, and we'll put you in touch. So you said you moved on from going from the behind the scenes to actually, you know, moving kind of, I guess, away from teaching into graded readers. We've not had anyone on the show yet that's
really
been a graded. We've had lots of course book writers. We've had you know, storybook writers like Patrick Jackson. He wrote Potato Pals. But
it's possible that Nicola Meldrum did a bit of graded reading.
Oh, that wouldn't
talk about it with her.
Wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, I'd like you to talk about graded readers if you can. I love using graded readers. I actually use graded readers as like for myself, just to go, oh, is this a book that I want to read? You know, like if it's an adaptation.
Yeah, exactly. It's like reading an abridged version. I did a project, it's a slight digression, but I did a project for Pearson where they needed a graded reader section matching to every unit of their course book. They'd chosen the books ahead. Okay. It was, and they were all like classics, and so I had to read the books and pick the section and then write some exercises to go from it. So I read like a ton of books that you should have read but I haven't, like English literature classics and stuff. You know, Middlemarch, I mean, that was 84 pages long. That was hard going. I don't know how anybody reads the full thing, but
so dated. Dr.
Jekyll
now.
And Mr. Hyde, I'd never read the, you know, I never read the original. There's a load of Dickens books that I've never read the original, but I know Oliver Twist, the graded reader, off by heart. So yeah, they're brilliant things. And so actually what I was writing was mostly original graded readers, where it just means you've come up or yourself rather than doing an adaptation. I've done a couple of adaptations since. Most people get into it writing the adaptations and then they might let you write an original one, but I didn't do it that way because I had written, well, I'd come up with the beginning, I'd come up with a story plan and I'd written three chapters and I tried to pitch that, and it was only because I didn't know what I was doing and didn't know how the industry worked that I tried to do it that way. And I had it turned down, and then I improved the thing that they wanted improved, but they weren't interested because I'd blown it. And so I sent it to the next person and they published it. But it's, you know, adaptations is one thing. You are trying to faithfully as you can reproduce what the original writer has done, mm-hmm. but you've got to do it in so much less length that you have to cut out, you know, huge chunks of plot. Now, where classics are concerned, plot isn't necessarily their strong point.
Yeah.
So there's a load of waffle that you can cut out, and you can collapse the 15 characters down into 5 because that's all it really needs. And I swear to God, if some of those people were trying to publish a book now, it would be so edited compared with, you know, what was allowed to pass as a classic then. But the modern books that I've done adaptations for are much harder to cut down because everything's in there and everything's necessary. It's moving the plot forward. They haven't got superfluous characters, so it's a bit more difficult. I did a Doctor Who one.
Nice.
Just fantastic. It's brilliant.
An original one, or are you adapting?
No, an adaptation.
Oh, okay.
An adaptation of that, and it's a lot harder because there wasn't really much fat to trim.
So what's the process then? So that one, it's... I can understand the classics. I'm not sure why there's not more graded readers for like Lord of the Rings or something like that. Probably gonna get shot for saying that because there's a lot of waffle. But yeah, one person's waffle is another person's. Oh my, this is my new life now.
I haven't heard many people who would argue that Tolkien was a great writer. He was a fantastic world builder. I think most people know that.
Yeah, maybe that's what gets lost. But what's the process? So what was the process with the Doctor Who?
So I have my own process, and I don't know if anybody else does it like this, but I view adaptations as an editing process rather than a writing process.
Okay.
So I start from the original. I think a lot of people just kind of try to rewrite it and make it sound like, but I don't do that. I take the original and I chop, 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 chop until I've so that's why it's really easy to preserve the voice of the writer, because then all you kind of simplify the syntax and the grammar and the vocabulary and stuff, but you've preserved it. And I did Adrian Mole, and that was the voice is so important in that, the humor. Like I can't write like Sue Townsend. It was Stu or Townend. I couldn't do it. So I view it as an editing process, and that makes it a lot easier. But I honestly don't think other people do it that way. Whereas with an original, it is just it's your story. So I'm pretty much a self-taught writer. So I went to a lot of writing workshops when I lived in Madrid. We had an excellent writers club, and we looked at a lot of things to do with plot and character and story arc and stuff like that. And so I'd come up with an idea for a story, and then I would go away and use the things that I knew about the 8 steps. I mean, there's lots of different ones, but like I use an 8-point story arc. And so I just like, where are my gaps? And I fit that, because then you make sure you've got, in simplified terms, a beginning, middle, and an end, but you've got, the obstacle and the overcoming of it, and then the setback and these kind of things. So, it's nice because you know that your story works if you do that to it, because it can't not work, following the rules. But it doesn't mean you come up with something formulaic. It just means you come up with something that is a story rather than just, I don't know, an episode or a vignette or a thing that starts well but doesn't end properly. And so the original things that I've done, I see them as films in my head. Like that's where I'm, that's where I'm starting from. I've created this whole thing. I've created the characters. I really care about what happens to them. So they are like writing a novel. It's just that you get to do it in 8,000 words. So takes some of the pressure off of, God, a manuscript that's going to take you 2 years to finish.
Yeah, it's interesting because, with the teaching, we also get to dabble with writing, and I know a new a few writers and just general creators, and a lot of people when they come to like writing less course books, more like graded readers, more materials based stuff, is that they're like, oh, how does it all work? And like you point out, it's kind of almost like math or physics. There's a Fibonacci sequence of how it works. It's it always works. There's always that what is it? Robert Mackay said it was like Mind the Gap. He's the guy that wrote Lion King. He wrote the Bible of. He's the Scott Thornberry of screenwriting. There's always one, right? So it's really interesting because it could be quite intimidating, but I think the way that you describe it is good because it makes it a little bit more approachable and digestible.
Yeah, definitely. Because I've had stories where I've been like, I know how it starts and I know what I want it to end, but I just don't know what to do in the middle. And and it is frightening because you're like, I've got these characters to here, but I need them to get to here. That's your mind the gap thing. What do I do? And the story art will tell you. I mean, you still have to be very creative around that, but at least you're like, okay, they need to have this happen.
It's really interesting, and I think that like we could do it, definitely do a writing under the covers because there's a whole behind the scenes aspect of that as well. My qu with the when you're writing the original, do you write already graded, or do you write full verbose and then go back and edit it down?
It's kind of half and half because I've been doing it for so long, plus I was teaching before that you tend to think in, the contents page of Cutting Edge is in your head. You know what the grammar structures are for intermediate. So you do a bit of it, but I do try to just write it and then work that out later. But I think I naturally do grade it a bit. And I think sometimes I find it the hardest thing to write C1 stuff because you actually shouldn't grade really. Like very little gets changed at C1. And so if you start doing that, you know the way that people speak to mm-hmm. foreigners, mm-hmm. You start doing that in your writing, it just doesn't sound good. It's much better to make it natural mm-hmm. and then work on it, because that's easy. But it's mm-hmm. very difficult to go from something stilted or graded to something that sounds natural.
I wonder why there's not more writers that tackle this area, because I feel like there's such a wide audience for graded readers. Yet I raise it to my students in the past, especially to adult students, and they're like, what are those? I'm like, what, you mean I can read something with my low level that's actually interesting and pertinent to me as an adult? I'm not just, reading
fairy tales
or whatever. And, I think one of the biggest examples out there is Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling, it's very much the first book is very much, like a graded series. It evolves from very basic to, kind of a lot more verbose.
And they are complex stories, even the complex concepts. So it's not true that just because something's written simply that you can't have a complex concept in there. Like my first one, the one that won mm-hmm. the awards, called The Tomorrow Mirror. It's about time travel. It's about predestination. It's about whether fate, whether your future is determined or not. It's the beginner, it's elementary or whatever. It's the very low level.
A2,
I was only allowed to use lower than that.
I think it was because
I was allowed four verbs that were in the past simple irregular. The others had to be regular. So I couldn't say like I ran. I had to say I didn't walk. I didn't run. I walked fast. That's how I got around that one. So, it was really, really, I think I had a vocabulary list of 300 words that I was allowed to use.
Interesting.
Still did it.
Wow. It's almost kind of like a challenge, I guess. I mean, that's what Dr. Seuss had. His colleagues were challenged. The whole green eggs and ham was actually just a challenge for being able to write with only a certain number of popular words or something like that, if I remember correctly.
Makes sense, though, and that's why they're so popular, isn't it? Because they absolutely fit that child's vocabulary level.
Yeah. Plus they're rhythmic, and there's something about rhythmical words that really just capture us. We've not even touched on what you're doing right now. You did teaching, you went behind the scenes with the academics, you went into graded readers and writing about that, and then content writing. How did that come about?
Yeah, I just, I love to write. And so it's my happy place. So I was blogging a lot. And then I was just, I lived in Spain. I can write about Spain. I had children. I can write about that. Mm. I can write. I've always said, tell me I've got to write 10 posts about lemons. I'll do it. It's what my brain does when it goes to a quiet place, is it's coming up with ideas and things to write about. And so sometimes I feel like not with ELT course books or anything like that, I'm not going to lie, but I often feel like I'm just channeling something. Mm. And that for me is like how I'm happy. And in the last few years, I haven't felt like that for a lot of the time, because I've been churning out stuff for people for money that is going into course books and things like that. And it's like, I'll do these commissions for people, and then I'll, for whatever reason, need to see it later on, maybe at final proofs, or maybe they send me a copy and I honestly couldn't tell you which bits I've written and which bits I hadn't, because they're not me. They're not my writing. They're not my ideas. They're just stuff I churned out, and I can churn. I'll churn, and I'm quite good at it, but it doesn't fire that sort of creative thing for me. So I was really just getting bored. And also, I just don't earn enough money doing it, so I can write whatever, but none of it pays, not well.
Yeah, and I think that brings us to where you are at now. And I'll let you explain what it is that you do right now with ELT and financials. But I just want to go over you know, your progression. So you went from teaching to going behind the scenes, not earning that much money, that much extra money, to then doing materials where, you know, maybe was that a little bit more lucrative than?
Yeah, it does pay better, and you don't have to leave your house. So
that's great. That's as much as I like to be. And then moving away from ELT into the content writing. So you're building up this skill set, and it's allowing you to, and this skill set's transferring over, and you're kind of almost being pushed away from teaching because it's not earning. So what are you doing now? Can you explain to our listeners and viewers?
Okay, so it sounds like a massive jump away, but you've got to remember that one of the things that I've got good at over the years as well is creating educational materials, and some of the things I've written, like things for other people's digital courses and stuff like that. So you've got to bear that in mind. But so I got interested in investing, which I'll say why in a minute, but I got interested in investing. I had to learn about it for myself. And then I was just like, I really love this. This is fascinating. Could I completely change? Shall I go and do a course to be a trader? Should I go back to university and do a finance degree? Like, what would that look like? What would I come out the end of it with? And those weren't really viable options for me, because they would have taken far too much time for a start, which time I just don't have. I've got to be earning money while I'm, you know, learning something, and that's, I can't do that on a full-time finance degree. And then I'd be competing with 24-year-olds for a job where I'd have to work 12 hours a day. So that just wasn't the way. I was just racking my brains going like, you know, what can I do? And then I just suddenly realized that, wait a minute, you can write educational materials, you can teach other people about this. And it was just the real light bulb, because ELT is an industry where people don't typically know about personal finance. And, you know, personal finance is several things. So, you know, it might be budgeting and, you know, how to handle credit and credit cards and that kind of stuff, which is not what I do. But, it, you know, actual investing, which is not trading. It's just putting your money in various different places in low risk ways that will grow money slowly for you over time, which is basically what pensions are. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's not only pensions, and pensions, as soon as you say that, it's just boring. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are other things that are not pensions, but it's just that pensions happen to be a type of investment. So it's like investing is one of those things where it's at the same time scary for people, because it's too exciting, it sounds like. And then you'd say pensions and people are like, well, that's boring. Well, which one is it? You know, is it really boring or is it too exciting and risky? And it's because it's just actually just normal. It's just a normal standard routine thing. But because none of us have been taught about it, we don't know anything about it. And the reason I started looking into the first place was just because I had some savings. They'd been sitting in premium bonds, actually, in the UK for years. I'd never done anything with them. They weren't enough to buy a house, you know, like put a deposit down. And anyway, I'm a freelancer and a single parent. No one's going to give me a mortgage anyway. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, what do I do with this? And I really didn't know at all what the answer was to that. I just knew I must be able to do something. Mm-hmm. And that just started a progression of questions because, you know, I'm a curious person and this turned into, what can, you know, I'm learning, but right? I was like, oh, I'm learning. And after a few months, I knew enough to put my, you know, my money into investments. But I don't mean that I started buying and selling shares and, you know, shouting at people on the phone. Like, it's not that. It's just opening accounts and deciding which ones are right for you and deciding which kind of accounts. And it's super easy. And convincing people of that is a real uphill battle, because a lot of people like me, they have savings, maybe don't really know what for, because it's not enough to do anything with. Mm-hmm. And they don't earn very much money, and that just becomes a block to even finding out about investing, because you think, well, for a start, I need lots of money. Mm-hmm. Or I need to spend loads of time on this because I'm going to be buying and selling shares. And it's just honestly the misconceptions that people have about this I relate to, because they're all the misconceptions I had. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to learn, so I found out about it, and now I can teach that to other people, because it's not that hard. But yeah. I feel like I say this to people and they don't believe me, so we've already got this kind of problem, because they don't believe me. It sounds like I'm selling snake oil, but I'm not. I'm selling you the same thing that your pension would be invested in if you had one, but it's just I'm going to show you how it works and I'm going to make you do it for yourself. and then you'll just make money.
Yeah. It's such a needed area. And I actually have a good personal experience with this to illustrate how simple it can be, but also how stupid someone can be, or just, you know, I guess ignorant might be the word as well. So where, you know, when I'm going around teaching, I'm saving, but I'm saving to go to generally the next place. I'm not really thinking about the distant future. And I'm budgeting. I'm not exactly in debt or anything like that. And you know, I'm a couple of different countries in at this point, and I'm just having a bit of a chat with another teacher, that a more senior teacher. I'm not going to say older. I'll just say senior. They're like they mentioned that they were sending some money back to the UK for their contributions, and I'm like, what do you mean contributions? What are those? Contributions? And they're like, yeah, contributions for your national insurance. And I'm like, you can pay your contributions. You're not in the UK, you know, to grow your pension. I'm like, wait, my pension isn't growing. I'm like, hold on. I think this might be something that I should look into. And, you know, since then, I've done my best to pay into that. But, you know, the issues are, you might have a really great lifestyle because of cost of living, you know, if you're living in, you know, Vietnam as a teacher. But when that money gets transferred over to do contributions, then that ain't much going over. So, you know, just simple things that you like for me, I was just not even contributing to my pension at all. So yeah, how just shining a light on that is super important.
Yeah, I mean, snap, I had it's the only thing that I had a small amount of awareness of, but still not enough. So when I first started this what am I going to do thing, the first thing I did do was go and see, like, what are my national insurance contributions, what are the years that I'm missing, which ones can I pay towards, because I've already paid some of it. So I topped up all the ones that I paid some of, and then I opted not to carry on with the UK ones because I have to pay a fortune here in Spain and I cannot pay into both. So I'm not, but it was the first thing that I did. And it's interesting that you say about the difference between long-term and, you know, short-term traveling budgets, because the thing is, not all investing has to be long-term. Stock market investing has to be long-term because unless you're lucky and it happens to go really well that year, but you have to look at it as a minimum 5-year game and really better 10, 20, as long as you've got to throw at it, really. But there are other things that I've invested in that pay out monthly. They just pay out monthly, like interest, basically. It's the simplest way of saying it. So they pay out stuff like interest, and you can either reinvest that or you could have it go out into your account. So, you know, and some of those investments can be liquidated fairly quickly because they're not stock market based. Mm-hmm. So you're saving up for something next year because you want to go to South America. If this year you are putting all, you know, your whatever it is you've allocated for your, you know, cash that's going to not be a part of your spending and living, whatever you've allocated, you put it into these types of investments, and that will grow at, you know, between 8 and 15% of the things I've got it in. And so you're actually increasing your ability to save for that short-term goal by having some of the money invested in something, but you'll be able to take it out. And it's important to know the difference, because obviously if you try to put your short-term money into the stock market, if you were doing that this year, you'd be having a hideous time. But these other things that I've got are just, you know, paying out, but I reinvest it. I'm not taking it out at the moment. I reinvest it. It will keep earning, but you know, there's definitely things you can do. And it's another thing that people don't realize. They hear you talk about investing and they think, oh, that must mean that I can't touch the money. Yes, for certain types, not for others.
Yeah, so it's basically like you've got certain tools or areas that you can invest into that you know have a limited time span, that you can, instead of just, you know, putting your, well, but I mean, at this point, savings accounts, you might as well just have the money in your pocket. So what, you're just going to, instead of just accruing and holding your money until you get enough to buy whatever it is that you want, you're accruing money, but then also putting it in something to kind of speed up the process. So instead of having to save a year, maybe you only have to save 10 months because, yeah, you know, two of those is you've got from the interest on those investments.
To get specific, Nicola, what would you recommend at the moment? I'm one of the people who unfortunately did invest in the stock market at just the wrong time.
Me too.
So I'm just watching my stuff at the moment. I'm just pretending that it's not real money. the thing is, at the end of the day, the money that I invested came from a £600 investment in Bitcoin.
Oh,
at just the right moment, and that blew up times 10.
Yeah.
So then I reinvested that, and it didn't do quite so well. But at the end of the day, it was a bit sort of easy come, easy go, I suppose. It's still doing better than the original investment anyway.
That's the right way to look at it. Like you said it exactly right. Like I pretend it's not real money. That's exactly what you should do. I mean, you should even not really look at it, but as long as you're looking at it and you're not doing something, you're doing the right thing. And so when you say, like, what would you recommend? Well, what I absolutely wouldn't recommend is Bitcoin, because that's not investing actually, it's speculating, which is a totally different thing, and it's really high risk, and you were really lucky. But the danger is that people go, look what I've done, I can keep doing that, and they can't, because they were just lucky. And that, you know, it might be that all recovers, but it's actually doing horrendously badly. And people said that it wouldn't. People said, oh, it's not tied to the stock market, this will be good when the stock market's down. Well, that's not true. So, or has turned out not to be true. So it doesn't mean it won't have its day again, but I think even though you're seeing it go down at the moment, you've done the right thing, because you've taken it out of something that's highly speculative and highly risky, and you've put it in something that will pay off as long as you can just leave it alone. So you've done the right thing. But as for a list of what I would recommend, this is difficult, because this is what people ask me all the time. One is, I teach a course in 6 weeks and it covers all of that. And if I try and summarize it into a list to spend a couple of sentences on it, then the danger is that because people don't understand, they'll just go, oh, she said 6 things, I think I'll pick this one. And they don't know what it is. They don't know how it fits in with the other things. And you've got to have a strategy that is balanced and diversified. And if you just pick one, that could be as bad for you as picking Bitcoin at the wrong moment. Yeah. Because, you know, one of the rules about investing is, like, and this is the one I struggle the most to remind myself of, is like, what's working now is not going to work later for some reason at some time. So you have to be in all of the things. And that's why the returns are not going to be 6x, 10x, 50x, because you're hedging and you're investing in low risk things. So, you know, I'd love to give you a list, but I don't want to be responsible for people going away and doing that badly. Yeah. Because they'll be like, well, Nicola said this and she's got a course, so blah, blah, blah. So it's just, you know, I've made the course as short as I can, and I don't think I waste any of it. So I honestly think you need to learn about it all, and then you can pick the things that are right for you and balance them in the right way with each other.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think we both, Rich and I, can appreciate that. Well, I think any teacher that's listening can appreciate that, because, you know, the amount of people that's like, how do I learn English? What do I need to learn English? And, you know, I think a couple of episodes ago, Rich said it best, where he's like, I'm you're less of a teacher and more of a coach. What was it that you were saying, Rich? Where someone comes to you and you say, yeah, this is for you right now, you can do this, but that doesn't mean that if you give that advice to everyone.
Yeah, the specific example we were coming up with was if someone come in at absolute beginner level, and I think to get someone who was an absolute beginner, my advice would probably be a list of things that they need to go away and do for 6 months, and then come back to me when they're sort of at, you know, kind of a good A1 level, where we can start actually working with stuff, you know. Because I think that the absolute beginner stages require a lot of your own practice and you know, getting the basics down. You know, there's no point. I don't think there's any point in sitting with a teacher for an hour going through the conjugations of the verb to be. It's ridiculous. You know, if someone doesn't know that, then that's the kind of thing they can go off and learn. Duolingo, I think, does a fantastic job of getting people to a kind of an A2 level if you go through the full Duolingo course. That's totally free and online. So, you know, why waste your time paying like premium one-to-one teaching rates? Go and do that and then come back and we'll have some interesting classes. I guess my point was that, yeah, you sort of, you're always considering what is the best thing, what is the best piece of advice that I can give to this person to get them where they want to go. And it's not always the most intuitive thing. I suppose that's where it fits in, where Nicola's now saying, you know, well, I'm not going to, I can't tell you, like, just go and invest in this one thing. You need to know all these things together before you can start to make a decision about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so, there are so many parallels with how somebody learns a language. There really are, because, you know, you cover the basics, and that's going to help you with the next thing. But the big difference is that it takes your whole life to learn a language, and it takes 6 weeks, honestly, to learn to invest. So.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where people, it's on the same level as learning a language, where people go, I've tried, I can't do it. Financials, I look at it, I can't do it. I see the numbers, I can't do it. I mean, we actually did a series called Teaching Masters, where we look at different educators that are not necessarily teachers. Like, we looked at Mr. Rogers. I don't know if you're aware of Mr. Rogers and how we saw him as a great teacher, but, you know, he's just a TV personality, but he's not. He's better than most teachers, in my opinion. And one of the people that we looked at was Robert Kiyosaki. He's got a reputation as a bit of a snake oil salesman. He's got a lot of, you know, conspiracy. He's a big personality. To put it nicely. But his books, Rich Dad Poor Dad, Cashflow Quadrant, and one of the things that we specifically looked at was his board game. I found to be very good at just, you know, going over just basics of kind of investing, how money works, and it's done in a way that he's almost like a teacher, in that he's been able to grade all this jargon from the financial world and make it more palatable and digestible to other people.
Yeah, Rich Dad Poor Dad is the one that I know. I think I'm vaguely, you're saying about the board game rings a bell, but I've never seen it.
It's called Cashflow.
Right. I mean, he's got his critics, but I honestly think most of his critics come from what he's tried to do later. He's kind of tried to turn himself into a bit of a guru, hasn't he?
Yeah.
But that book changed a lot of people's entire attitude towards money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and for that, he deserves the place that he's got in that kind of story, I think. But it's, this is the thing, I think one of the problems with the whole thing is that because there are these gurus, people get attached to that idea, but actually, and then it makes it look like you need to be following these people, you need to be listening to every word that comes out of their mouth. But the thing is, once you've learned it, if you're not interested, like, okay, I'm interested in it, so I want to keep hearing about it and reading about it. But if you're not interested, you don't have to be interested beyond the time it takes you to learn how to do it, because then you just set your stuff up, forget about it. You don't have to take an interest in it. Like, you don't have to become somebody who cares about money or become somebody who talks about pensions at the dinner table, which is who I've become, but, you know, that's okay.
Well, that's a write-off, so it's okay.
Yeah, it's so funny, like, you know, people ask me things now and I'm like, well, I know this stuff and I'm quite happy to talk about it, so I will.
Well, people want to know about it, because I think generally there's a feeling that there's so much happening, especially, I mean, September 2022, We've seen quite a lot of inflation. We've seen a lot of ups and downs with the economy, and people are worried and concerned about, you know, the money that they have now, right now, and the money that they have in the future, because, you know, they're investing so much time in work that, you know, they're not sure if it's going to pay off in the future. So to have someone that to can explain it and to put it in a more succinct way that they can just learn and go, then, you know, that'd be great for them.
I mean, the cost of living crisis is on everybody's minds at the moment. This has been a horrific year. Winter looks like it's going to be terrible. And, you know, I get from a lot of people, I can't afford this right now. And even people will say to me, I know you're going to say that I can't afford not to. And it's like, yes, I am going to say that. But they're too afraid. They just want to like hold on because, you know, that feels safe. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that you could still be investing just a little bit right at the moment and establishing the habit, and eventually things will kind of return to normal and you'll have started a habit that's then gonna set you up for a lifetime and you'll have made a little bit of money.
Yeah.
And free money's good, isn't it? You know, making a little bit rather than a lot of it, still free money.
I agree. One of my friends with teaching said that hope is not a plan. I think this was this was a lesson plan where I think early on in my career I was just confidently go, yeah, I'll just walk into the classroom, I've got a bit of experience, I'll come up with something, and yeah, hope is not a plan. And I think that definitely applies to the financial world. What is it that you think about your skills and your background with education that you think really helps with being able to, I guess, grade all this financial knowledge?
I actually think it's less that experience than it is just having myself started off with not a clue, no financial background, no financial literacy, not even understanding what questions I should ask. I have like this story, like in my newsletter, like you go through a kind of introductory sequence when you sign up to my newsletter, and I explain to people how I started this thing. And, you know, I was asking a friend who knows all about finance and has got a PhD in physics and, you know, is a programmer, and I think he's some kind of trader or something now. And I asked him, like, what would you do if you were me and you had this amount of money, but you didn't know what to do with it and you couldn't buy a house? And he gave me an answer about, well, I'd do this, this and this. I didn't understand the word that he was saying. And he had explained it. He was breaking it down, but he was starting, you know, but one of the phrases he used was risk skew. And I know what the word risk is and I know what the word skew means, but I still didn't know what he was talking about. So I think it's the fact that I'm not somebody who comes from a background even vaguely like that, so I don't use loads of jargon and stuff because that's not the language that I kind of speak. So it's that more than the sort of designing educational materials and grading. It's not that. It's that, look, I know what you don't know because I didn't know it. And I did have a little fear the first time I ran the course that I was simplifying it too much. I was like, people are going to know this. They're just going to be like, why did I sign up for this? But people didn't know. And then I relaxed and I was like, yeah, okay, everybody's really the same as me. So I just explain it from the ground up. I start with compound interest and risk and I go from there. You know, what is risky in life? I talk about that.
That's really interesting. And I think it's a really good point with the simplifying language. That's why I push back and I say that it sounds like you're transferring the skills from, you know, graded writing for it, because it sounds what you're doing where you simplify, but you're just doing it from a place where you had to grade it for yourself to begin with, and then you later went on to teach that.
Yeah, definitely. It would be a nice parallel, but I definitely can't claim it.
I forgot what my next point was. Oh, go ahead, Rich.
What are you investing in the moment, Neil? Because I know you're trying to put some money away at the moment, aren't you?
I'm not right now. Well, I do have some Bitcoin, some Ether. I do have some stocks, but I don't even think about
you're
them.
In the, and you're in the same situation as me, basically.
Yeah, but whereas you cashed out, I didn't. But I made all those investments at the very beginning of the pandemic, and I've not really tracked with them. I've personally just been reading myself, trying to understand concepts and what to do. But you know, at the present moment, you know, I've got a little one, a new baby coming in 2 weeks, yay me. And you know, I've got a toddler, and you know, my wife's going to be finished working as well. She's going to be on mat leave. So you know, there's absolutely no slack whatsoever, and you know, rent's going to go up as well. Yeah. at the turn of the year. So yeah, there's no slack whatsoever. So I'm currently not even thinking about it, and Nicole must be rolling, her eyes must be just going rolling in the back of her head, going, and I completely agree, because you know, like, hope is not a plan.
In some ways, you would be someone who would be a prime sort of, you know, should be someone who's sort of chomping at the bit for Nicole's advice, right? But you can't, you're not prepared to do it right now. And I think there's probably going to be a lot of people in that situation, isn't there? Like, with the way things are doing, with the cost of living, and especially, you know, language teachers who are like infamously poorly paid, really. I think one of the big things about language teaching is how little it's sort of standardized. You know, you can work at one place and be getting less than the cleaners, and then work at another place and getting quite decent salary for the area, you know. Not so many of those jobs, but there are some of them. So yeah, I mean, is there anything you could say, Nicole, to someone like that, who doesn't really have a lot of money, of how or what they should be doing? Maybe it'd just be a case of they should be trying to increase their income, right?
Yeah, I mean, increasing your income is the first and best and biggest way of actually making a difference to your financial situation. You know, obviously, because that's you know, you can make a, I don't know, 10%, 20% increase in your monthly wage. You're not going to do that through investing unless you've got a massive pot of money. So it is the first thing. But the other thing is that, I mean, just to like put some maths in there, if you invest £1 a day, or $1 or whatever currency you want for 20 years, and you put it in something that's making 10%, which is achievable, you know, it's on the higher end, you in 20 years, you will have physically yourself put in £7,201, I think it is. Mm-hmm. It will turn into 20,000 something without you doing anything other than leaving it alone. And if you are able to leave that for 40 years because you're in your 20s, and this is your classic TEFL teacher, if you just start doing that, you'll have £159,000 in 40 years without doing anything at all other than that. And of course, if you can do £1 a day now, mm-hmm. you're going to find you can do £2 a day. And and then you're going to find that you know, your situation improves, and you're like, oh, I'm going to put in, I don't know, 200 a month. Mm-hmm. And then the numbers start flying by. So it's this thing of, I get it, there's no sort of fat to trim at the moment out of people's finances, but whatever the magazine is or the thing that you spend some money on, your kids like, I want sweets today, and you just say no, no Chupa Chupa lolly today, because I'm putting that in an investment account. So you can take it from somewhere. And I've got my 7-year-old, every time he gets any pocket money or anything like that, I say to him, like, you know, and actually he says it to me now, he says, Mummy, I want to invest half of it. So he puts it, you know, I've got it in this silly little account that started off with €69. I think I'd have to go and look at it. He's made about €3. But if he keeps doing that, he's going to develop this habit. And if a 7-year-old starts, and this is the thing, like, even if you're not thinking for yourself, start it for your kids, because in the 20 years until they would need it for going to college or whatever, you could have saved and invested and gained a significant chunk towards their whatever it is they do next. So I do understand, but it's just part of these fallacies and misconceptions that we have about it. Because you really can start with just a little bit, because time is the biggest player in this whole equation. But of course, the more you put in, the better that maths is going to work in your favor. You know, you've just got to start. And when you start based on a position of understanding, because what I'm hearing from both of you is a real willingness to learn, but you're going for the shiny, exciting crypto stuff. And that's gambling. It's like, if it's exactly the same as if you'd said to me, look, I've got some money, I'm going to go to the casino. You know, don't.
Okay, that's
that.
What we do, Rich. That's what she just said.
So, you know, choose the other stuff. Choose knowledge. Oh, this is going to sound like train spotting. Choose knowledge. Learn about all the other much more passive, low risk things. Leave the shiny stuff to somebody else, and just do that with a little bit until you can put more in.
I mean, what you've said there makes a lot of sense. Definitely. I think one of the other problems that you would come up against there is sort of people's natural tendency to not be able to weigh up accurately the benefit of things in the future. I suppose I don't really know the right way of putting this. Like, is it like delayed gratification or something?
Yeah,
like
it
that?
Is partly that, isn't it? It's coming from that same bit of our brain that's not very good at it. Because, you know, on an evolutionary level, you do just need to know what's in front of you right now and you need to react against it. It's like your lizard brain keeps you alive, but it's your logical brain, which I've now forgotten what the name, is it the frontal lobe? I can't remember anyway.
Prefrontal cortex.
Prefrontal cortex is the bit that you actually want to employ when you're thinking about this. You want to go like, you know, logically, what should I be doing? And your instincts will tell you, to be honest, with money, the wrong thing.
I completely agree. And I want to reiterate to all of viewers out there, and I'm also talking to myself when I say hope is not a plan. So a plan would be to get in touch with Nicole and find out what you can actually do from here, or get a plan from her. How do people do that? How do people get in touch with you? And also, can you give some sort of final thoughts on what you would like to share with our viewers as we wrap up the episode?
Right, well, I'll do the easy bit first and hopefully I'll think of something while I'm doing that. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Nicola Prentice, but my website is www.chilledinvestor.com, because that's the philosophy that I want to kind of, you know, teach. It's like, this isn't a big deal, just chill out, you can do it. And if you find that website, I'm actually, my next course starts next Wednesday. I'm not sure when this goes out, but next course starts next Wednesday, and I've got their places still going on that, but the next one will be in November. But you know, sign up to my newsletter so that you hear about it. I tell like the story of how I got into this stuff. My newsletter is my favorite thing to do because it's like blogging, you know. So I write that for fun, even if nobody was listening, but people are listening, they're opening it. And so that's how to find me. You know, write to me and find out, you know, what the course involves. But I wouldn't write to me and say, I've got this amount of money, what can I invest it in? Because I just, in all good conscience, cannot tell you that. You know, all I can do is tell you what I'm invested in, and that won't be right for you. So I think my big thought is really just understand that money makes money. And once you've got, 'cause that was my massive light bulb moment. I was like, rich people are not working for their money. Their money is making money for them. And just because they're rich and they're doing it, the same maths and the same principles applies to you, even if you're going to put little bits in, because your money will make money if you make it do it. And so just learn this stuff. Why we are not taught it at school, I don't know. But if you want to go on the conspiracy angle, it's because we would all retire at 40, 45, and who would be left to work? So we're not taught it because it's not in a lot of people's interests for people to, you know, this is really what capitalism is. Capitalism is making money off your capital. And we all think that we're you know, capitalist in some way, probably, because we live in a capitalist society, but the capitalists are the ones that are doing well out of this, and we're not. But you can be a socialist and you can make your money work for you. So there you go, that's my final
thought. I love it, and we'll stick that at the beginning of the episode. We'll just have a couple of laser eye thumbnails and a clickbait title, and we'll get all the crypto bros here.
edit down the internet. There you go.
Oh, I'd love a load of crypto bros writing to me and telling me why I'm wrong. Brilliant.
So if you're watching out there, crypto bros, leave your comments below, but more importantly, get over to Chilled Investor, sign up for Nicole's email, and you know, have at it, because she loves it. Well, really, thank you for coming on the show. It's been a whirlwind, and also it's been highly embarrassing to air out my dirty financial laundry. But I think it will be helpful for a lot of other teachers out there, because I know many are in our position. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really a lot of fun.
If you're looking for more information from myself, you can go to teamteacherchina.com. We've got a whole bunch of materials, PowerPoints that you can use instantly in the classroom. We've got a Team Teacher China YouTube channel where we have videos teaching you how to use those materials. Team Teacher English, where we put those materials into a video form for self-study. And Team Teacher Baby, where I take my experience as a teacher and put that into parenting.
And go to youtube.com/professorrich to see some English teaching. You can catch me weekly live streams on Oxford Online English YouTube channel. Oh, and also you can do a YouTube search for POG space UK, and you would get my alpha version of my new gaming channel, which actually just have some trial content on there at the moment. You can email us here at eltunderthecovers@gmail.com if you have anything you'd like to contribute to the show.
Smash that like button, share and subscribe.
And watch 100% of the video and don't click off. Thank you.
Bye.